In the last year, we heard some proposals along the way to talk about loan assistance programs to help with getting people into professions, smooth the pathway into professions when they come out of college with a significant amount of debt. This is one such proposal, which I hope that you will consider. This would assist lawyers who are going into the service of the public as public defenders, which means that they would be literally public servants on the public payroll and providing legal services to those who are in the criminal justice system facing a criminal charge, facing the potential of going to jail if they are convicted, but who do not have the financial resources to hire a lawyer to represent them, to hire a private lawyer to represent them. The Constitution guarantees that they are entitled to a lawyer to defend them when they are facing jail. But often what happens is, depending on where in the state you're dealing with, sometimes three-quarters or more of the people in a courtroom on an arraignment calendar on any given day are indigent and qualify for the public defender. It is rather shocking if when you might think most people can afford a public defender, but it turns a private lawyer, but it turns out most people who are in the criminal justice system cannot. What happens as a result, then, is that these lawyers are facing massive caseloads and a lot of on-the-job stress and very little pay for the work that they do in particular, and certainly for the options that they have if they were to choose to go into the private sector to earn a living. So they are indeed providing a constitutional public service. One of the additional stresses they often face is a significant debt load for their school debt when they choose to go into this job. That means the 4 years of college and the 3 years of law school that it takes for them to get licensed to practice law. So we are presenting to you an option for a publicly supported law school loan repayment assistance program. I have said in this committee in the last year when another similar program was considered that I myself am the beneficiary of a loan assistance repayment program. Mine was provided through my law school, but it enabled me to afford to go into public service when I got out of law school. For me, I worked as an assistant attorney general in Minnesota, but without that ability, it would have been without that assistance, it would have been much more difficult for me to be able to maintain, stay in that job as long as I did. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Kevin Kyer on behalf of the State Board of Public Defense, who has a presentation for you.
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. First of all, let me thank Senator Latz for bringing this bill forward. It is a major issue that our folks are facing. And let me thank, Madam Chair, you for scheduling the bill and allowing us to be heard here. It is not often we get in front of this committee. In fact, this, I think, is our first time. So as a way of a little background, and as Senator Latz alluded to this, is our folks handle about 175,000 cases a year. About 85 to 90% of all serious criminal cases are handled by public defenders. As you get down into the area of misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, we tend to see a little bit more private counsel in the courtrooms. We have about 550 lawyers around the state that provide this service. About half of them are part-time. As we get outside of the metro area, about 60 or 65% are part-time. And that is one of the major issues that we are facing. Why we're here, we have a major issue with recruitment and retention, particularly recruitment when it comes to part-time public defenders in greater Minnesota, retention when it comes to issues of keeping folks around, particularly in the metropolitan area. There are just a lot of options, or a lot more options, I should say, that folks have when we're talking about the metropolitan area. On page 3 of that handout, you can see some of the issues that kind of why we're here today. We have a baby boom workforce. I don't think that's any great surprise to you all. You have been dealing with this on a number of fronts for a while. We have what is really an inverted bell curve when it comes to where our lawyers are. We have an awful lot of folks who are just starting out. We have an awful lot of folks who have been doing this work for a long time for us. So we have kind of this inverted bell curve in terms of years of experience. Again, Greater Minnesota recruitment of part-timers, the retention of public defenders, particularly in the metropolitan area, increasing law school debt, and a federal program which was passed last year, which really sets up a situation where we're going to have kind of a divided workforce. In relation to the baby boom workforce, about 40% of our part-timers are age 50-plus. About 30% of all of our staff is over age 50. Of those who are over age 55, about 3 out of 4 are part-time defenders, and I'm going to explain in a minute why that's so important to us. The last 2 part-time positions that we had open in Greater Minnesota, one in the 6th Judicial District, that area of northeast Minnesota, and that's page 6 on your handout, we had no applicants for. We only had 3 applicants for the last one that we had in the 9th Judicial District. Part-time public defenders handle the bulk of cases outside of the metropolitan area. They are paid on an annual basis based on their percentage of time they work for us. They get a small stipend for their overhead, about $3,500, $3,400. We don't pay for their legal secretary. We don't pay for their rent. We don't pay for any of those things. They take whatever cases come down the pipe. So they kind of gamble on when the cases are coming, how many are coming, and the difficulty of those cases. And as all of you know, those case numbers have increased dramatically, especially in a lot of parts of Greater Minnesota. So as far as the part-timers are concerned, they are really the bulk of and the stalwart, if you will, of the public defender system once you get outside of that metropolitan area. This is also an issue nationally. We've seen it, if you see on this slide on page 6, about 68% of public interest and government employers reported difficulty recruitment of lawyers. Retention of attorney staff. Last year we did a survey to find out exactly what our situation was among public defenders regarding their debt. One of the questions we asked was, is it highly likely or likely that law school debt will force you out of public service? Over 40% of the lawyers said that it was highly likely or likely they would have to get out of this work. We had about a 10% attrition rate in 2006, which really alarmed me. Among state employees, generally, if the last I looked, it was somewhere around 4 or 5%. Now, maybe a little higher because, obviously, the state's dealing with some of the same issues we are relative to their baby boom workforce. But this was extremely high for us, probably double of where we've been in the past. Again, nationally, about 62% of public interest and government employers reported difficulty in retaining lawyers. Public employers citing law school debt as a barrier to keeping and recruiting lawyers. Again, if you look at page 8 of the handout, 88% and 82% respectively. Again, this is not something the public defender system is dealing with, but all public employers are dealing with. I think we have a little bit tougher issue only because, number one, as Senator Latz mentioned, the pay issue, but also the caseload issue. Our lawyers handle about double the caseload standards that the ABA and our own weighted caseload standard says they should be handling. What's really been disappointing or disheartening as we've looked into this is, if you look on page 8 again, a 267% increase in tuition at law school since 1990, which, again, I don't think is any surprise to you all because you've been dealing with that issue for a long time in this committee. And about 66% of the graduates that indicated that debt would prevent them from pursuing a public interest career, a public service career. I think for all of us, that's really some alarming numbers. In terms of public defenders, about 65% of our defenders reported a current debt. The average debt is about $74,000, and again, that's just law school debt. It doesn't include whatever undergraduate debt that those folks may be carrying. And if you saw the Star Tribune over the weekend, that is a significant chunk as well, at least especially here in Minnesota for some reason. $586 is the average monthly payment. And again, one that's really concerning to us is about 54% of the respondents have 6 or less years of experience. So we really are looking at a group of people, again, as I said, in that inverted bell curve, who are carrying an awful lot of debt and who are very likely to leave our service because of law school debt. The current law school debt, again, if you turn to page 12, is I think another one that's very alarming, at least to us, is almost half of the folks had $75,000 or more in debt or in law school debt. Again, it's a very disturbing trend for us, considering that we start our lawyers at about entry level about $51,000 or $52,000 a year. So if you can imagine trying to make that law school payment of $575 along with, or $585, along with your house payment or rent or whatever it is. The as I mentioned, one of the issues that's before us is a potential for a kind of a split in our staffing. Last fall, the Congress passed the Federal College Cost Reduction Act, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, or a number of you are. It provided loan forgiveness after 10 years of public service. Problem with it is part-time defenders aren't eligible. So all those folks who are part-time defenders in your greater Minnesota communities aren't eligible for that loan forgiveness. Your public service is prospective from October 1st of last year forward. And here's the one that as we did more investigating of this, was really disappointing, is the vast majority of the debt incurred by our full-time defenders is not eligible for the loan forgiveness because it's either privately held or some other debt, or there's an economic disincentive for the employee to participate in the program. And just, if I could, Matt Gerald, just back up just a step, is a few years ago, a number of the lawyers, in fact, almost all of them, were able to consolidate or refinance their loans at a low interest rate. And there was a window of opportunity where the interest rates went way down, and some of you probably had heard that. They went ahead and refinanced all of those loans. Now to turn the table to say, well, we're now going to refinance or we're going to consolidate those loans, either as a federally insured loan or as a direct federal loan, at a higher interest rate. They're now gambling that they're going to be with the public defender system for the next 10 years. So it really doesn't provide any economic incentive for them to go ahead and participate in the program. So what we're asking for, and again, let me again preface this by, we understand the financial burdens that you all are facing. Okay, we're facing some of those ourselves. But I think we would be remiss in not bringing some of these issues forward in terms of the long-term stability of the public defender system. As Senator Latz pointed out, and as I mentioned, the vast majority of folks who are going into court have a public defender. If we're not there, if we have folks who aren't trained well, if we have folks that are inexperienced, that slows the entire system down. And I think a number of judges will tell you that's been their experience. What we are looking at is, one, the authorization for the program. And the funding would be this. We would provide up to $4,500 per year for a period of 10 years towards someone's loan repayment. That is roughly the equivalent of what that federal loan program would do, the loan forgiveness program, if, in fact, somebody was able to participate in that and they had a $74,000 loan. It would be full-time defenders. Our intent would be for full-time defenders hired prior to October 1st of 2007 and all part-time defenders in the system. Madam Chair, that's my presentation. There is a federal loan repayment program I should make you aware of that's now pending in Congress. It has been pending for a number of years, and the information that we've gotten so far is the The possibility of that passing is not likely. Again, the federal government's facing some of the same financial issues that you all are facing. And also, at least the information we have right now says that part-time defenders would not be eligible for that program either. So that's, Madam Chair, my presentation. I do have, Madam Chair, just Corey Sherman is a public defender here in Ramsey County, and she's, I don't want to say typical, but she is pretty close to typical, and if you could give us 2 minutes to have her come up and just kind of tell her story. I think it's pretty typical of public defenders, at least in the metro area.
Okay, so that would be fine.
Thank you.
Hello, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, thank you. As Mr. Kyer indicated.
Would you just repeat your name for the tape,
certainly,
please?
Certainly, it's Corey Sherman. It's Corey Sherman. As Mr. Kyer has indicated, I've been an attorney in Ramsey County, which is the second judicial district, for about 2.5 years. I graduated from Hamline University, and I was fortunate enough, actually, to get a scholarship for 75% of my tuition there. Notwithstanding that scholarship, I still have about $65,000 worth of student loans for law school alone. That does not take into consideration anything that I have for my undergraduate debt. I have a starting salary of approximately $53,000, which during tax time is kind of difficult because it means my net worth is zero. But unfortunately, I'm not alone, and unfortunately, other people in my office are much worse off than me. I thought that I was in a bad situation, and then I spoke with another individual in my office who pays about $1,075 per month in student loans, and she's just started in our office. This is the situation that many people in my office are facing at this time, and many of us wanted to become public defenders because we, like I'm sure all of you, believe in the Constitution and we believe in public service, and we want to continue our roles as public defenders. The unfortunate part is that right now I'm working 2 additional jobs so that I can pay off my student loan debt. I get paid more money to tutor law students at Hamline than I do to be a public defender. I also work a second job in catering to make ends meet. It's very difficult to be able to continue to live this way and to work this way. At some point, I'm going to have to make the decision that a lot of people in my office have made, which is, at what point do you leave the public defender's office and go into private practice? I'm single right now, and I don't own a home, but at some point I might want to buy a home, and I might want to have a family. And that's when I will have to make a tough decision as to when I want to leave, because I won't be able to afford to stay in public service any longer. In fact, another coworker of mine just recently left our office to become a prosecutor because prosecutors get paid much more money than we do as public defenders. So those are some of the issues that we are facing, and which is why this repayment assistance bill would be a wonderful thing for all of us. And I think that it would not only affect our clients and help us to be more effective representatives of our clients, but it would affect the entire judicial system. When we have time to spend on our cases and when we have energy to spend on our cases, we can move cases more smoothly and more quickly through the process. Now, that's not my role necessarily, and that's not my job to help effectively move cases through necessarily, but it is a result of having effective, well-trained public defenders who have been around the system for a long time and who are trained. And unless anyone has any questions, I will take my leave.
Any questions?
No, Chair.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Did I understand you to say that your starting salary was about $57,000?
53 is what I'm making currently, and I've been an attorney for about 2.5 years. When I initially started, we were on a lower pay scale, and I believe my initial salary was $49,000, about.
And you said your student debt was about $1,000 a month?
No. My student loan debt personally for law school is $60,000. I have undergraduate debt as well. My monthly payments are about $750 a month for my undergraduate and law school debt combined.
For how many years?
I graduated from undergrad in 4.5 years and 3 years of law school.
How long will you be paying?
The term.
Senator Tomassoni.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
I was spacing out.
I just kind of blurted it out.
Most of my federal loans are on the 30-year plan. However, I do have private loans, and with private loans, you cannot kick them out as long as you can with the public loans. So the highest amount of, in terms of payments, were for public loans.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Tomassoni,
if in the event you get married and have children, when your children go to school, you'll still be paying off your student loans.
Absolutely.
Chairman. Mr. Kier, I'm sorry. I just forgot my question now. Since I mispronounced your name, it threw me. Oh, okay. So remind me how this works, because why would Ms. Sherman be making a different salary than the prosecutor? Aren't they? They're not both paid by Ramsey County?
Madam Chair and members, the public defenders are state employees, with the exception of Hennepin and Ramsey. All of those folks hired prior to 1999 are county employees. But otherwise, they're on a statewide pay scale, one bargaining unit. So they are paid differently than the prosecutors, which are a county-based system.
So because you said only the employees hired prior to 89 are part of the county system.
Madam Chair, prior to 19,
public defenders.
Prior to 1999.
1999. That was when the
those folks were grandfathered in as county employees.
Okay.
All new hires since 99 in those two districts are state employees.
Okay.
Everybody in the other eight judicial districts and our appellate office are all state employees.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
gotcha. Senator Clark.
I definitely support this, but I just want to, just a couple of things mostly, because I'm sorry, I missed the beginning part. I know you talked about it. Last year, we passed and the governor vetoed the loan payment assistance program, and I know that they've been working out the glitches, and this was for public interest, non-criminal attorneys who make even less, I mean significantly less. And given we're in this budget time, I do have a couple of concerns. So we're not bringing that back this year. We can't, because we're not going to be able to afford it. Senator Pappas and the rest of this committee are going to have to look at ways that we're going to be trimming. And you know, for what it's worth, I graduated in 92. I made $22,000 a year with a $67,000 a year debt, $800 a month. And by the time we got done with that, I think we were starting to think about college. So I totally support this. But I have a couple things as you're moving forward. My understanding was that you guys were going to be looking at absorbing this within your current budget. So as you move along, I think that's something you might want to think about given the budget deficit, because this is an important thing, but you might have to think about that. I also think that it's important to be identifying what part-time means, because if somebody has one small contract, I'm not sure from a means-based standpoint that that's where we should be. I mean, and I'm totally with you, so it's a little challenging for me to say this. I think we should probably do both things, and I think we want to make sure we're floating all boats as high as we can, and if within the public defender budgets on the state standpoint, we can figure out how to do this, and we can't clearly figure out how to do the other right now, we should move forward on this, and we'll come back next year to work on it. But I think as you're moving through to judiciary, since that committee is likely to be thinking about, or I'm sorry, public safety, right? They'll be looking at budget-related issues there eventually. I mean, if there's a fiscal note attached to it, it's going to have to go to Senator Higgins. Foley's budget. And I know he's already having to think about how he's going to absorb cuts. So just a couple of things. So I think what you're trying to do is important. We want to obtain and retain the best people here, but we've got to figure out how do we get all boats going up. And I am a little concerned that somehow in the middle of all this we're not figuring out how to get the other people taken care of too. And I know that's not your budget.
Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Kier.
We do understand that, and we understand the financial situation. But we thought it was important. This is a major issue facing all of our folks, and the one that they identified, and frankly, we identified. And so we will certainly take that to heed, and we will, as we move forward here. just to address the part-time issue just for a second is, as far as employees, we have three different groups of part-time employees. They either work three-quarter time, 50% time, or 25% time. The vast majority of our folks are three-quarter time for us, which means essentially they get three-quarters pay of a full-timer, but they essentially get a full-time caseload. When I first started this, or first started working for the board, we had a number of very prominent greater Minnesota law firms that were represented as part-time public defenders. And those folks were doing it because they had done it under a contract basis, county basis, whatever. When the state assumed the cost, they stayed with us. What was interesting when we did this survey is the number of people who are now in one- or two-person firms. Basically, they do public defender work, and that's it. They do a little bit of civil work, but not a lot. And that is a dynamic that has changed dramatically in the last 10 years, maybe. Maybe not even that long. So, but those are the folks we're talking about. So,
and Madam Chair,
Karen Clark,
I know a lot of those folks, and they work really hard, and they're not getting very well compensated. So, I just think as you move along, though, you might want to help Sarah Foley's committee see how it is you're addressing that as opposed to something else, because that is something we look at across the board, I think, in other places. And absolutely, those folks, they're the ones that are really getting shortchanged the most under our current system, and we need to have them keep doing it. Thank you.
As we've looked at some of the criteria, we don't see anything that makes the that uses any kind of needs criteria, you know, income eligibility criteria, which you typically you see in a financial aid program. Have you thought about that at all?
Madam Chair, we have, although, again, as we went through the survey results and we took a look at where our staff is, at least on the part-time side. Again, full-timers are prohibited from practicing law outside of public defense work, so we're really talking about just the part-time folks. Again, the vast majority of those folks are working 75% time for us. They are putting in an average of, well, probably somewhere around 1,500 hours a year for us. So the income eligibility, while we took a look at and we would take a look at and whatever we would do, I just don't think is a major issue for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand if people are full-time or even if they have a small contract, but we don't have a lot of – those folks don't work for us. They're contractors. So that's where we've looked at it.
What about people who just have kind of inherited wealth? Inherited wealth from their families.
Madam Chair,
they
I
tend
guess,
not to have law school debts then and not wouldn't be eligible then?
Madam Chair, yeah, I guess to the extent we do have some folks, believe it or not, who don't have law school debt that work for us. Generally, they have come from families of some means who are able to pay that. Or as in the case when Senator Latz mentioned that, you know, there are a few law schools, very few I would suggest to you, that have some kind of loan repayment assistance. And usually the income criteria is pretty low. I think Senator Clark mentioned the LRAP program, I guess, for a better term. I think as we were talking to those folks about, you know, possibly running this program, their income limit is like $37,000 a year, I think, maybe, and that's household income. So it's not a lot. Mm-hmm. So would there be, yeah, I mean, could there be some folks who have some inherited wealth that maybe are paying a law school debt? Yeah, I guess there could be, you know. We'd certainly want to take a look at that.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I realize that public defenders are not well compensated for as attorneys. I mean, in the general compensation structure for attorneys, public defenders are really on the low end. But, you know, the level that of pay would light up the eyes of a lot of graduate students that are coming out of college, even though we might consider that low. And I guess I have a bit of trouble because we hear from our other students all the time that they're coming out of school with $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 worth of debt, And you know, they're becoming teachers and other things that we also value. And I guess I have a bit of a problem targeting a group that in the end really will have a lot of earning potential. They may not start out high, simply like teachers maybe don't start out high either. They start out much lower than this, of course, too. But I don't know where it ends when we start doing something where the earning potential in the future is quite high.
Doctor's another good example. Senator Latz, do you want
Madam
to
comment? Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, part of the challenge here is not what their future earning potential is, but is getting them to even consider this job, to do it at all. And then once they're in there and they gain some experience, to keep them there. I'm a better lawyer now than I was 5 years ago or 15 years ago when I left the Attorney General's office. But I opted to go into public service, and I had that flexibility because I had a loan assistance program that I could utilize to give me that flexibility. I like to think, at least, that the 6 years I spent there were of some help to the people of Minnesota, not just to me gaining some experience. I know that public defenders, when they're working every day, every person that they talk to, they're giving help to. I do some volunteer work probably 4 to 8 times a month in the Hennepin County courts, just giving free advice to people in the courts. And most of the people I'm giving advice to are the ones who applied for and did not qualify for the public defender. Yet they can't afford to hire a private lawyer. And they certainly have no idea what they're looking at when they get into the court system. And I can see situations where they walk out of there not as well served as they could have been in the process of the system. But if the purpose of the program is simply to defray debt, then income testing it in the whole bit is appropriate. But if the purpose of the program is to enable people to come in, to recruit lawyers who do have other options to serve the public as public defenders, and then enable them to remain in that position after they've gained some experience, then it's not so much a question of what's their future earning potential. It's a question of where are they here and now. If we don't do something like that, their future earning potential is going to pull them right back out of the public defender system. And they'll go off somewhere else, like to the prosecutor's offices, where the counties are paying a lot more. When I was at the Attorney General's office, Hennepin County Attorney's Office paid $10,000 a year more than I was being paid. So in a lot of ways, the state has failed to shoulder its responsibility for adequately compensating its employees in that regard. The least we can do is try to set up incentives when we do take over responsibility for employees to try to recruit the best and the brightest into these positions, which are so important for the people who come through the system.
Senator Latz, in the program we funded last year, the idea was to give the lawyer kind of a yearly payment while they were working as a public interest lawyer. So now, it wasn't to pay off their entire law school debt, which you're right, they would have a much easier time doing if they worked in a big law firm. But to help them while they were doing the job of being a public interest lawyer, being a public defender. Is that the intention of how this would work, too, is they would get an extra $4,000 or $5,000 a year in loan repayment?
Madam Chair, that's precisely what we're talking about. So that for those first years as you're a public defender, or people in Ms. Sherman's position, that we're able to not only recruit people of her caliber, but also to keep them. And again, as I mentioned, in greater Minnesota, this is a huge, huge issue for us because the whole system relies on those part-time defenders. Mm-hmm. And that's a growing population for us. And I don't know where we're going to get the lawyers to replace them. The days of somebody coming to, Grand Rapids or to Virginia or Hibbing or Mankato, or maybe not necessarily Mankato, but some of those places, and hanging out a shingle with the thought that we're going to give them a public defender part-time job and they're going to be able to recruit business and keep a law firm afloat, just aren't there anymore. And I think you've experienced it with doctors. I think you've been experiencing it with nurses. Mm-hmm. We're a little late to come to the party, actually. And I think that's been because our folks have just hung on for so long, just because they believe so strongly in doing this work. But as I mentioned, I saw on the one slide, or you saw on the one slide, all three out of every four of the defenders who are age 55 and above are part-time. Again, I don't know where we're going to get to replace them. So that's why we're here, recruitment and retention. That's what it's all about.
Okay, any other questions? Then the Judiciary Committee would like to see the bill. So, Senator Latz, if you want to make the motion.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 3020 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on the Judiciary.
Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, thank you very much. Good luck. Senator Coring.
Madam Chair,
Senator Coring,
I'm not a lawyer, but
are you a veteran? Are you a child of a veteran?
Madam Chair, before you today, you have Senate File 2327, and it's making a little bit of a change. And I did have a conversation with John. I can't see your last name. Is it Fuller? I just know your first name.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Fuller. I had a conversation with Mr. Fuller, and we were kind of trying to decide whether or not we even needed on the bill this, where I have the new language under number 6, because if you look at number 5, it kind of does it, but it doesn't really do it. And I talked to, when we had this up in the Agriculture Committee, the folks from higher ed said that I did need to have this. Is that correct? Okay. And so let me just read you a letter that the reason why I'm doing this is because it was a constituent of mine that wrote me an email.
Madam Chair, before
Senator
you go
Tomasoni.
Senator Coring, do you drive your hearse with those eyes or do you have glasses?
Huh? I do have glasses. Yeah, why?
I mean, if you can't see Mr. Fuller's name, you need glasses.
I just need glasses for distance.
Immaterial.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Off the subject. Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to just read you this quick little email that I received from a constituent of mine. It says, my name is Jesse Ray, and I was honorably discharged from the Navy a year ago. I grew up in Brainerd. During my time in the service, I met my wife, and we moved back here after I got out of the service. She was from Connecticut. Due to Statute 136A.101, subsection 8, she was not eligible for state-funded grants for financial aid. According to this, she would have to put her classes on hold for a year. I feel that a returning service member, family members, should be considered a resident student upon moving to the state if the spouse has maintained residency during the time of service, which I have. Thank you for your consideration. And so that's why I move forward with this small little change to make sure that this doesn't happen. I guess there's a fiscal note, but I guess I don't know how it could be this at $16,000, but I guess I kind of question that. Do we have anybody that could comment on that, Madam Chair?
Yeah. Mr. Misconis, did you want to?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was kind of
curious
to just towards that. Thank you, Madam Chair. It would seem like since it's a finite pot of money, it would mean that it would impact is somebody else, that we're not actually growing the budget any, so.
Not at all, no.
Mr. Misconis.
Madam Chair and members for the record, my name is Mark Misconis. I'm with the Office of Education. Let me just speak to the fiscal note. As we put this together, it's clear on page 2, if you look at it, under the assumptions that we had to make some, as in many cases like this, doing fiscal notes that in the third paragraph there, the 10% of the spouses were not Minnesota residents, or half those would attend college and receive state grants, so they would fit the definition in the new language. And out of that, those assumptions, we came up with the $16,000, and again, based on an average grant for 2007. So there's an awful lot of assumption there that may or may not be correct. In fact, I'll assure you they're not correct. Having said that, though, as Senator Cornyn said, there is at least one person out there that this would affect, because that's why the bill has come before you, because someone's impacted. So there would likely be a cost to that. Now, that's different, and I'm sure that Mr. Albrecht is in a situation of having to carry a cost, and I'm going to suggest a reason why he wouldn't have to. One is that this is a fixed appropriation, the state grant program. It is not an open-end standing, and it is not a forecasted program. So any additional cost would have to be carried inside that appropriation. Mr. Albrecht can correct me if I'm wrong, but if the accounting rules for budgeting are still the same as when I was here, we'd have to count this otherwise as a cancellation. So there would be a cost. And I would suggest that it may not be necessary here is because the agency has the authority to move money between this program and other programs. So to the extent that there was a surplus here, it wouldn't cancel. It would be moved to child care, work study, or some other program for which you already have current rider authority.
Or extra LME.
Or extra LME, Madam right. Chair, yes. Yeah. So even though I think within the program one could identify a cost, I think for budgeting purposes one could suggest that one that would not have to be carried.
So are you going to do a revised fiscal note, or are we just to ignore this?
Madam Chair, I think, again, within the program, we don't look at how we move money around between the programs because we just don't know how much is going to be available. So I don't think that we would change the fiscal note per se, but it might be worthwhile, and I've already had a bit of a conversation with finance about this and how that should be treated given the transfer authority.
My question, though, is that then is if I carry this in the what's going to be a policy bill only, or if it gets sent to full finance to be part of the bigger finance bill. That's kind of my question. So I think we might have to lay it over while we figure that out.
Madam Chair, again, members, I think just a clarifying conversation with the Department of Finance would be helpful
There's
no issue.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions as to what Senator Cornyn wants to do here?
Madam Chair, do we want to hear from higher ed on this?
He was from higher ed.
Okay.
He was from the Office of Higher Education.
Okay.
Okay, so.
Madam Chair, I just hope that we can work this out because this is, it's obviously not important to, a whole bunch of people, but it's obviously it's having an effect on a young man that has served his country, and now him and his wife are trying to attend Central Lakes College, and I would sure appreciate any help on this bill that we can. So do we
Senator Cornyn, my staff tells me that on 2.1 that you don't really need or dependent, that is already covered. And according to the fiscal note, dependent children of veterans are already defined as residents.
Okay. So then it would just be spouse?
Then it would just be spouse.
Spouse of a veteran.
Right.
Okay.
So do you want to move to delete or dependent? Is that right? What do you think, John? John, you need some?
This is at the time.
Not totally the same, so we should keep it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we have a disagreement here. Why don't we keep it to be safe?
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then, Madam Chair, what's your wishes on this? Do we just lay it over, or?
I think what we would do is I think we have to lay it over for now.
Okay.
But we certainly can come back to it, and with our intention would be if with the committee's support is that we'd either put it into the policy article or we would send it to finance to be part of the big finance bill.
Okay.
And because it has a little bit of a fiscal
okay.
connection with it.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, thanks. So the bill's laid over. Okay. Senator Sharon, do you want to come sit up here and share?
The next bill will be Senate File 2846, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a legislation that I authored last year and that was included in the bill. but we neglected to add, it's called the TEACH program, but we neglected to provide for some administration expenses for the nonprofit to be allowed to have that. And so Ms. Ann McCulley, the Executive Director of Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network, is just going to comment on the difficulties that's created and ask for our support. Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. McCulley, to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to address this. Just to refresh your memory, this is a scholarship program that helps early care and education teachers, providers go back to school and get their higher ed degrees. And we have been able to put out 53 scholarships so far this year with the higher education funds for a total of $167,000. Because, however, there is not administrative costs built in, we've had to pull back a little bit. And so our request is just to have 5% of the dollars that you've allocated be able to go into the cost of running the program. We have about 1.5 FTEs that act as counselors for these students, and we have about a 0.25 bookkeeper, and those are the main costs. The rest of the funds for the program do come from the Department of Human Services, from some federal funds, and for now that has been covering those costs, but moving forward we would like to make sure that we have some of the funds out of the state legislation money as well. Sure. I did bring a brochure. We never miss an opportunity to talk about the program, so I brought you an updated brochure that talks about what we're doing and how we're helping child care providers.
Thank you, Ms. McCulley. Are there any questions from the members of the committee? Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's actually not quite a question, but a comment. I think that it's very important that we make sure that there is some ability to at least cover the administrative costs. Know you run a lean machine, and hopefully, especially as we go into the next budget year, we'll have a chance to also keep thinking about how we can partner with higher education to keep broadening the training and retraining for our early learning teachers. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Okay. And, Madam Chair, we actually can start building the omnibus bill. And so I'd like to move that Senate File 2846 be incorporated into the omnibus higher ed policy bill.
Senator Pappas moves that this be incorporated in the omnibus bill. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. The next bill will be Senate File 2942, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. If you recall, with our state grant program, in order not to run surpluses that are too high, that during times of deficit can be taken by the administration and used for things other than our state grant program, we instituted I think they do it like twice yearly, option for the Office of Higher Education to move more resources into the living and miscellaneous expense category so that those dollars can get allocated to students. And, within a few million dollars, they're generally able to do that. However, it's been considered kind of an experimental program. We've done it for a number of years, and it does have an expiration date in law. And I would like to remove the expiration date so that we continue to use LME as our mechanism, and until we come up with a different or better idea. But for now, that seems to be working well. And we want to hear from maybe Mr. Mishkanish, you want to comment on it, how it's going?
Welcome, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, again, for the record, Mark Mishkanish with the Office of Higher Education. This has been in place for a few years now. We have aptly implemented it last biennium. It worked very well. We made two changes and I think spent most of the appropriation for the state grant program through this mechanism.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Okay, then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 2942 as is be incorporated into the omnibus bill. It's actually going to be the omnibus bill, but
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
All right, thank you.
We add the amendment on?
Can you put your amendment on?
Add this amendment on?
Move to reconsider.
No, we can put it in later. Okay. This is going to be 29 to 42. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can. Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's such a busy day around here. I think it's everybody's day on the Hill today. So there's lots of visitors. I just want to introduce Senate File 3387, and it comes from us from the Office of Higher Education, and it actually has some provisions in it that are fairly technical in nature, and then there's one provision that we want to look at, too, that would allow an academic number that students have when they are in K through 12 to follow them into the higher education system so that we can do some tracking and some studies that might be very useful for us in the future. But there are several articles to the bill, and the first one is about student financial aid, and it relates to the Indian scholarships. And perhaps last session you remember that we were moving the Indian Scholarships Administration from the Education Department to the Office of Higher Education. And as that transfer was made, they discovered some changes in statute that needed to be made with it because there were some administrative practices taking place that didn't quite match the statute. But apparently what they were doing was working well for them, and now they want to get the practice in line with the statute. I suppose we could have insisted that it be the other way around, but it might have ended up in some problems. You know, Senator Pappas, too, relating to that, I do have an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that I need. It's a technical amendment, the A1. Maybe we should do that right away. And it really is just a technical amendment, basically, that our counsel and Ms. Weedman found when they were reviewing the bill.
Thank you.
It provides some further clarification.
Okay, let's make sure everyone has a copy of it, and then we can move it.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
In talking with Ms. Weedman, it is possible to get an Indian scholarship as a graduate student, but currently the statutory language we proposed did not actually lay out how the award would be calculated. And so this would clarify how an award for a graduate student in the program would be calculated.
Okay, Senator Roebling moves the A1 amendment. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And as well as that clarifying language on the Indian scholarships, we also have some clarifying language on the ACHIEVE scholarships in that same article. And I don't know, Madam Chair, if you want the Office of Higher Education to review those two articles before we move to the next one in some more detail, and maybe if members have questions, they could do that while we're in the first article.
Idea.
And so I think I'll turn it over to whichever one of you wants to review this article.
Madam Chairman, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. In the course of preparing to do the first ACHIEVE scholarships, which would go out after July 1st of this year, we have taken questions from the public, high school counselors, financial aid administrators, and so forth, and discovered a few areas that simply needed more clarification in this brand-new legislation, and that's what we're proposing. It's some additional documentation that students could provide and clarifying that recipients must graduate from a Minnesota high school. The documentation is that if a student wanted to count a post-secondary enrollment options course as for one of the core courses they have to take to have taken rigorous courses in high school, if it's not on their high school transcript, we might have to ask them to submit a post-secondary transcript. That's basically what we're doing.
Otherwise, the other things are more technical. What are you doing on 414?
I'm sorry. That is the original language did not have a minimum credit load that students would have to be enrolled in mm-hmm. post-secondary education in order to get the Achieve Scholarship, and this would make it consistent with our other financial aid programs, particularly the state grant program, that you'd be enrolled for at least 3 semester credits or the equivalent. Usually that's one course.
One course. Mm.
There are times when a student may be taking athletics or choir or band or something that it might be a one credit course, but in general most of the academic courses are 3 credits or more.
So in order to get the Achieve Scholarship, you don't have to be in college full time.
No.
This is basically saying you can just be taking one course. And is that wise? No, it's $1,200 scholarship.
Madam Chairman, I believe it's prorated if you're part-time. I would have to double-check that and get back to your staff.
It's prorated, you think? It's not? You don't think it's prorated?
Okay, it's not. All right. I'm sorry. I'm mistaken.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I think that sounds a little generous.
Is there any rationale for why one course would be make you eligible?
Well, the award is $600 per term, and so a student who is taking one course would actually be eligible for $600 that term and another $600 next term if they just took one course.
That's it. That's all the money they would get.
That's all the money they would get.
Yes. Well, they could renew for a second year.
Right.
No? I thought you could get a second year.
Can you do 4 years?
I thought you could renew it for a second year. That's my memory.
No, it's available to you for 4 years.
Oh. You know, these things change so much. It's hard to remember.
I know.
Right.
Maybe we need, like, just kind of a basic explanation of the Achieve Scholarship Program. And, you know, who's eligible, how much money. I think we need a refresher because last year we changed it so many times.
That's true, Madam Chair. The bill that we originally heard here was not the bill that was approved in the end, and it happened a lot in the process and not in here.
Right.
So it's good to be refreshed.
Madam Chair, Megan, members, my name is Megan Fitzgibbon. I'm the manager of scholarship programs and for the Achieve at the Office of Higher Education, and I am working with the Achieve Scholarship. Quick review, the students who graduate from high school after January 1st of 2008, so a majority of those are going to be ones who are graduating this spring, they have to have completed one of 4 different rigorous programs of study. Those are the same rigorous programs of study that are used for the federal academic competitiveness grant. They're determined by the Department of Education and issued. They have to have, the only difference between that is that they would have had to have received a C or above in each of the courses in one of those 4 rigorous programs of study. They submit an application and their transcript, as well as those additional documentations if need be, in order for us to determine if they meet the requirements. Then if they have less than $75,000 of household income, so for a dependent student that would be their parent income. If it was an independent student, it would be their income reported on the FAFSA in the year that they would receive it. So if we were looking, as an example, of someone who graduates this spring and would be attending in the fall, it would be the FAFSA they're completing this year, and it would be reporting their 2007 income. Then if they meet those requirements, they can get they're issued a $1,200 certificate, basically, is the way I'm looking at it. They have up to 4 years to use that $1,200. So they will let us know, by acknowledging the award, what school they're going to and when they want the funds to come. If it was a typical example, we would expect them to want to use the funding when they have it, and they would probably tell us they'd want to use it in the fall. starting in the fall. It's split in two terms. It's kind of deceiving because it says it's a one-time scholarship, but it's in two terms. So they would take the first term, get $600, up to $600. It would only be up to their cost. So if they were taking a three-credit course and their cost for that course was less than $600, they'd only be eligible for what that is. But then if they successfully complete that first term, which the school will be reporting to us, they would be issued their second term award of $600. And then they are there's no more renewal unless they had a balance left over of that $1,200. Our assumption when we were looking at the credit load was most of the time even a three-credit course would probably be about $600 if you put in the books and supplies and everything that goes along with it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I don't know who can answer this, but on page 4.23, where we've eliminated a 30-day deadline, what is the 136A.121 subdivision 13?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that's the same deadline as the state grant.
Yes.
So we're just tying it in together.
Which is what, though?
It's 30 days right now. So we're just tying it in so if there was ever a change to the state grant deadline, this would change as well.
Okay.
Okay, that's very helpful. Senator Weaker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that the qualifying programs are parallel to four programs at the federal level. Could you just highlight what those four are, to show the rigor?
Madam Chair, Senator Weaker, this is the four programs. There are two that are a set of specific courses. They're an example are like four years of English, 3 years of math. There's one that's based on essentially the Minnesota coursework that's required to graduate with the exception of a foreign language component. The other two are a PSEO or dual credit where they can take two courses as PSEO students at a post-secondary institution. They have to receive a specific grade or above, and then they would meet that program. The other program is also an IB or AP, International Baccalaureate, or AP courses where they can take two courses, or they have to verify that they took two AP or IB courses and both got a passing grade in those and got a passing test score.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. You said you could take a PSEO and qualify.
Madam Chair, Senator White, that's two. They have to take two courses.
In PSEO.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Weaker.
Just trying to focus on the rigor on PSEO. We, in the E-12 policy committee, we've had some testimony that you can PSEO courses. Guitar, yoga, FI Ed course, and there's been some complaints that value, perhaps, but is that the intent? Mm-hmm. And those would be
Madam Chair,
potential
Senator
PSEO
Weaker.
Courses that you might take.
It has to be one science course and one math course. So they wouldn't, and they have to get a B or better in those PSEO courses at the college level. So it would not include a PSEO course. It would be a music course or something. It would be one of the more rigorous courses.
And I take offense at your idea that yoga is not rigorous. It's very rigorous. Trust me.
I've tried it.
Anybody stood in their head lately?
It's ugly.
I want to see Tomasoni do it.
It's ugly. I want you to know.
Any other questions for Ms. Fitzgibbons?
That'd be a good field trip.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Members, we do want to make sure that we mention that this is on top of other financial aid programs, so there isn't another need component to it, just the less than $75,000.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
College within school.
Okay, we did think that the staff does think we need some clarification of that $1,200, and they want to just kind of discuss that with the Office of Higher Education before we move forward on that.
I wanted to go back to the Indian scholarship section and just to see if we had any issues or any questions about that section, if it's just mostly technical. Anybody have any concerns about that? Staff took a look at it. Seems okay. Okay. Then I think we could go ahead then and move to incorporate Section 1 of Article 1 into the omnibus policy bill, which is going to be 2942. Senator Roebling, make that motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that we incorporate Section 1 of Article 1 into the omnibus policy bill.
Senate file 2942.
2942.
Okay. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevail. Okay, now we're back on achieve. And let's see if we had any. Oh, this one we're going to work on a little bit, so we're not going to incorporate it now.
Madam Chair, did you want to move to Article 2, the private institutions language?
I wanted to see if there was any other questions on the achieve section. I've got some notes here. We talked about income requirement. What's this? Subdivision 4, number 6. Oh, yeah, we talked about 3/4. Right. Subdivision 13. Why is subdivision 13, why is this necessary?
Madam Chair, there may be occasions when the first term the student enrolls is, for example, spring semester, and so that they would get their first payment of $600 in spring semester and the second payment in fall semester. Well, then that gets you into a different fiscal year, a different academic year, and so we would need to review their income again.
Oh, okay. You go by the fiscal year, not by the calendar year?
Yeah, we go by the financial aid year, which is the fiscal year, same as the fiscal year.
Well, we're going to hold this article. We can have some more discussions about it. Okay, let's look at Article 2.
Madam Chair, Article 2 are all technical corrections in language that is about regulating private institutions, post-secondary institutions. As you may recall, last year we did a fairly major rewrite of the statutes so that all of the degree-granting schools are now covered by the provisions in 136A, and all of the non-degree-granting schools, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit, are covered by Chapter 141. In the course of doing all of those corrections, there were a few things we missed, and these are just corrections and clarifications in that language that was adopted last year.
Okay. And were there any questions from members of the committee? And I think our staff reviewed this section.
Ms. Ryan, did you say that Scott McMahon had a comment? I forgot what you told me. Is he here? Mr. McMahon, did you want to say anything?
Not on this article.
Not on this article. Okay. Okay. Okay, so Article 2 looks like it's ready to go.
Madam Chair, then I would...
Oh, Senator Weaker, just a minute, Mr. Roebling.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. It's not addressed in here, I believe, but perhaps germane. I was talking to some people recently about... schools that might potentially offer degrees with not a real promising hope that there may be a job. To what extent do we have items that assess? I see we look at the curriculum and approve different things, but when you're churning out diplomas, and I know that some of our public schools are going to limit graduations, but is this germane at all to what is done here?
Madam Chair, Senator Weaker, we do have standards that degree they have to meet in order to get a program approved, and if you'd like to hear more about that, George Rodler on our staff could tell you in more detail.
Well, Madam Chair, the specific is in terms of how many diplomas and maybe that for the private sector, right, private schools, do we put any guidance or restrictions on how many diplomas are issued, especially with a very tight job market in some areas and other areas not a prospect for getting a job or a reasonable prospect.
Madam Chair, Senator Wicker. My name is George Roeder. I'm the manager of private institution registration and licensure for the Office of Higher Education. We do not have requirements, any kind of a need requirement for degrees or programs, either under Chapter 141 or under Chapter 136A, the private institutional registration. If the schools desire to present a program that meets the required standards for faculty, classroom space, and so on, and they have the financial ability to provide that program, we would approve that program. They don't have to show us that there's any need for it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I know this is an issue with all of our institutes of higher ed, and in fact, it's one of the – I'm on the topic selection subcommittee for the legislative auditor, and that is going to be one of the 12 program evaluations that legislators will soon be able to vote on. We have to get that down to 6 programs that the legislative auditor will review. But one of the concerns that has come up is what Senator Wicker has been asking about, is it, especially we don't have a lot of control over the privates, but over MNSCU, are there too many programs putting through too many students that will not find jobs in those areas of employment once they complete their diploma or their degree or their certificate? And is there some way that we could possibly look at regulating that or, you know, trying to steer students away from certain areas where they're not where there may not be ample employment? And so
we hear from the career colleges a lot that they're very nimble and they're very market sensitive and they can kind of move their programs around and emphasize others and, you know, not others depending on the market. But we've been hearing complaints for years. For example, the electricians have been complaining to us a lot about electrician programs offered at all 16 MNSCU two-year campuses and 600 electricians sitting on the bench. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also going to be on the topic subject when we have our joint hearing next week with the House on technology. I think this issue is also going to come up. And you know, we should all vote for that on the for the state auditor so we can get some kind of research and guidance there.
Right, because it may be happening, Madam Chair, in a number of other programs. I know, you know, massage has been extremely popular, and I don't know how many people who go through that program are actually able to make a living off of that once they've completed
it. We should all really help that field. Massages. That and yoga.
But that is something that we're going to be looking at. But it will, I don't know that we'll be able to regulate the privates. You know, ours is specifically targeted at MNSCU in particular. You know, I suppose one way we
but
could.
I think they advertise, you know, certainly if it's a false advertising issue, because they advertise their job placement rates, don't they, Mr. Rodler?
Madam Chair, the degree-granting schools, many of them have to keep track of placement for their accrediting bodies. Mm-hmm. Once they are degree-granting, however, as a part of 136A, the institutional registration, they do not have to provide us with it, although we ask them to provide us with copies of it. And I would add that the massage has, in fact, had some attrition in the number of programs being offered over the last year or two. A couple of small schools have closed, and some of the larger schools have just shut down those programs.
Mm. Reached saturation. I guess there's only so many massages you can have, right? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Rodler.
Thank you.
Let's see. So we were about Article 2?
Article 2. So like that's ready to go? Make a motion to incorporate Article 2 in Senate File 3387 into the Omnibus Higher Education Bill number 2942.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, Article 3 is some clarifications in the Minnesota GI Bill. These are not in our typical statute. These are in the Veterans Affairs statute. The appropriation was made to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Veterans Affairs has done an interagency agreement with our agency so that we are the ones actually running the program. And, again, as we have taken the questions and concerns of veterans and talked with veterans advocates and aid administrators, we have identified a few clarifications that in definitions of the amount of tuition recognized and specifying that their minimum benefit would be $50. If the student qualified for less than that, they would not get a benefit.
Okay, so Ms. Grimes, in Section 1, Subdivision 1G, the list of medals awarded, does adding all these other medals, does that expand the list of the eligible population? And if it does that, does that mean it's going to cost more and you need a fiscal note?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that it does not. My understanding is that sometimes it's difficult to document whether the student had served on active duty in a foreign country during a time of hostilities. But if they had one of these medals, they clearly would have served in that capacity. And the medal and the documentation that came with it would be the way we could verify that they had done the right kind of service.
Okay. Okay, and 1417. What's the difference between applied for, applying, and completing and submitting? That's the change there.
Oh, Madam Chair, Ms. Fitzgibbon reminds me. The difference here is that grad students are eligible for these grants, and only undergraduates are eligible for Pell Grants and state grants. And the FAFSA serves, the free application for federal student aid called the FAFSA, serves as the application for both Pell Grants and state grants. So rather than saying they have to have applied for a Pell Grant or a state grant, which wouldn't be the case if they were a grad student, we just say they have to have filled out a FAFSA.
Okay. Okay. Let's see.
Yes.
I had a question back at page 12. For the definition of eligible institution, could counsel refresh us as to what 136A1.101 is, sub 4? And as you're looking, the question would be this. At lines 12.23 and 24, it says grad school only serving graduate students, and there could be grad schools that serve grad students as well as students working on their bachelor's degree. You can register for courses sometime in the grad school for something. And I just want to make sure that grad school would be inadvertently
Ms. Grimes.
Ineligible.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that 136A.101 subdivision 4 is institutions that participate in the state grant program. And again, the state grant program is a program that's for undergraduates. There are some institutions, for example, the Alfred Adler School of Psychology, that only has graduate students. Mm-hmm. And the intent here is that in addition to the schools that are eligible for the state grant program, graduate schools that are licensed or registered through the program that you just heard about from Mr. Rodler would also, students at those schools would also be eligible.
Is that an expansion of the program, or was there originally intended that graduate students would be?
It was originally intended that graduate students would be eligible. It's just clarifying the language.
Okay.
But, Madam Chair, just
Senator Weaker.
On the point again, there are graduate schools like the University of Minnesota where students may take courses in the graduate school that may not be graduate students.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, my understanding, Senator Wieger, my understanding is that undergraduates would be eligible no matter what, whether they're taking graduate-level courses or undergraduate courses.
Senator Wieger. Madam Chair, I recognize that distinction, but I'm referring to the definition of graduate school here, and your definition of graduate school limits it to graduate schools only serving graduate students.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, thank you for the clarification. I think I understand the question now. Certainly the intent was that if, for example, it's the University of Minnesota and your graduate school there, that they would be already covered because the University of Minnesota also has undergraduate students. So that institution is already included in the definition because they have undergraduate students. What was not clear without this language was that an institution that doesn't have any undergraduates, that the students would be eligible, and we were just trying to add them.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Senator Wieger, were you at line 1223, or where were you at?
23 and 24.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay. I was just going to say that we already covered most of the institutions, but this just adds those additional ones. And I imagine it could even be like Mitchell-Williams,
yep.
School of Law or the psychology program for graduate students only. So we just want to make sure we have them all covered.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions on Article 3? Senator St. John.
Madam President.
Madam President.
Madam Chairman, and to Senator Roebling or anyone else, going back to the 13... The area of 13, 4, and 5, where we start listing various metals and so on, experience, is that to tell me then that if you are a soldier and somehow that you are never deployed, you may spend all your time in San Diego or Norfolk or someplace like that, that you would not be eligible for this, or maybe perhaps even if you were in North Korea, since it's not listed, although it may be on the line 13-6, but I guess are we distinguishing soldiers versus soldiers with foreign experience?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that was a feature of the original legislation, is that it was to apply to veterans who had served in an area of hostilities and not to soldiers who might have served all of their duty stateside or not, where they ever ended up serving in an area of hostilities.
That's right. Okay. Thank you. I just think more about this later on, but I wanted to clarify.
Senator Roebling.
I did hear some interesting information that I think we allotted $6 million for this, and we weren't sure how much money we needed or how much we would use, and we did put the limitation on because we had to put a limit on the amount that we were going to put into the budget for it. At this point in time, a much smaller amount has been sought by veterans than we anticipated.
Oh, okay.
And it isn't being handled right now by the Office of Higher Education because it was turned over to Veterans Affairs. But there very well may be money left over. Maybe even a fair amount of money left.
Not for long.
Not for long. Yes, got that right. But when we were doing this, we really didn't have any good estimates. But they have discovered, as people have applied for this, that this is last dollar. Mm-hmm. So what they found out is a lot of these veterans are qualified for a lot of other financial aid, and so the amount that they need to complete their funding for their education has not been as great as we might have anticipated at first. And so there is a significant money that is not spent yet, or it may not be spent, that we appropriated.
They're able to use this to cover the entire cost of attendance, right? Not just tuition and books.
Madam Chair, they're able to use it to cover the recognized tuition. So it's not all of tuition at private institutions. It's the same amount of tuition that we recognize in the state grant program, plus a living allowance. And then actually that budget is increased by 10% for the veterans from what it would be for state grant recipients.
Madam Chair,
Senator Senjum.
It's the council pointed out the OR on page or on line 13.5, which I hadn't noticed initially, and perhaps does help a little bit. There are other questions, you know, if you're out and spent 6 months or a year under the ocean in a submarine, I don't know what country you would be in, but perhaps those folks don't qualify. So. Again, and I understand the limitations of the budget, so we need to think about that as well. But it's hard to find fairness here.
Ms. Fitzgibbons, are you doing this program too?
Yes, I am.
Did have a question for you, but were you going to answer someone else's question first?
I was just going to answer the question about the medals, Madam Chair. This caveat under one here with the medals is actually in addition to the normal definition of veteran that's within the other Veterans Affairs statutes. So it includes those that have 181 or more consecutive days on active duty. Okay. And this is just, and I think one of the reasons, just to point out one of the reasons why it's here is in Minnesota we have a number of Air Force Reserve units that sometimes get called up for very short time periods. And so this additional caveat for 90 days or more is tried to catch those students in particular, those Air Force Reserve members that might only be called up for short periods of time, but they would be called up to do things like this, flying from here or another base to Iraq or Afghanistan or Kosovo in these short periods of time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So tell us if these veterans are eligible for other things. So they're eligible for the Pell Grant, and then they're eligible for the state grant. And then what is between that and this Minnesota GI Bill, what else are there federal programs that they're eligible for?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, a number of the students that have applied are eligible for the federal Montgomery GI Bill and the other Reserve Education Assistance Program and other programs that cover while they're in school. I'm sure many of you are aware of the students that or veterans that came back that were caught in the 729-730 day. A number of those students, when we were doing estimates, we had assumed would be getting the lower Chapter 1607 Reserve Education Assistance Program benefits, which are about three-quarters of the federal Montgomery GI Bill Chapter 30 benefits. Many of these students are now over that and are now getting about $200 to $300 more a month while they're in school. Another thing that's come up that I know we didn't estimate was the number of students that are eligible for what's called the GI Bill kicker. These were used as either recruitment tools or they paid in or different things, and many students are getting $200 to $600 extra per month on top of these other benefits. So that really, I mean, if you look at a semester that's, you know, $4,000, $5,000, in addition to the other financial aid they may qualify for, like Pell or state grant.
So how much of the $6 million has actually been spent?
Right now, what I have for the fall semester was a little over $1 million.
Wow.
And I would assume about half of that. We're expecting a few more students to apply for the spring semester because many of those same students that were caught in the 729-730-day issue either didn't enroll in school because they didn't know what kind of benefits they were going to get, or because they came back so late in the summer, they decided to take a semester off before they went to school. So we're seeing an increase in the number of applications for the spring, and we're expecting an increase for next year, but definitely it's going to be less than $6 million.
Does the money for the first year roll over to the second year?
Madam Chair, no, I don't believe so.
We have disagreements. You don't think it does? Does anyone think it does? Roll over. We typically like to do that, but maybe we forgot here. So this year it cancels back. If it's not spent, it cancels back to the general fund at the end of this year. Ms. Grimes, you think it rolls over?
Madam Chair, normally when Office of Higher Education programs, it would roll over from the first year to the second year, but because the appropriation was actually made to the Department of Veterans Affairs, I simply will have to check and get back to you. I just don't remember whether they have a rollover provision in the appropriation that went to Veterans Affairs. I'm sorry.
Is it too late for us to do that? Maybe we should do that. Do a rollover provision, and then maybe it wouldn't be declared surplus until next year. have a little time to decide what to do. Maybe we could shift the money back to us and into Achieve. This is the problem with letting the money go. Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, another question regarding the campaign medals, 13.11. There's reference to September 1, 2001. I was wondering if you intended honor after September
11, 2001. Cancellation. I'm not sure.
Ms.
Fitzgibbons, I'm sorry.
Is the question addressed to?
Whoever, answer it.
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure if that was supposed to be September 11th. The program itself requires service after September 11th. It may be that it may have just been...
Just an observation as we put this together that maybe, I think, Veteran Affairs might have additional insight. And again, this was all laid out initially by the governor.
This bill hasn't gone to Veterans Affairs. Does it have to?
Madam Chair, similar legislation is in an agency bill that Veterans Affairs will be proposing that's still making its way through the governor's legislation clearance process, because I believe it's part of a package that would have some fiscal costs, which is a different kind of an issue this year. But the plan is for the same language to be seen by the Veterans Affairs.
We should just make sure we coordinate and that we're doing the, whether it's in this bill or that bill, the language we agree on.
Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chair, I'm not sure I understood. What happened to those GIs that missed qualifying by 1 or 2 days? Did they ever get their benefits?
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, my belief is that most of them have been able to go through a process to appeal for that to be fixed, and many of them have already received new discharge paperwork that shows the 730 days. I know there was a long process by which they had to fill out something like 15-page application and things like that that were going on. But my understanding is many of them have already been able to do that and have already started receiving the higher benefits.
Madam Chair, do they have to qualify for the federal benefit before they can qualify for the state benefit?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, they have to meet the requirements of the Minnesota GI Bill, but if they are someone who doesn't necessarily meet the requirements of the federal Montgomery GI Bill, they still may be eligible. There are some areas, especially with the reserve education benefit that's through the federal Montgomery GI Bill, because those require you to still be drilling or in active drilling status with National Guard or Reserves. So someone, a student could, finish and not re-enlist, and they still would be eligible for the Minnesota GI Bill, but because they are not actively drilling, they wouldn't be eligible for those programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Then are we ready to go with this article?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Roebling? Except for the rollover, and we'll still look at that.
Okay.
What? Oh, fix something? What's wrong with the state?
It's the whole article. Okay, Madam Chair, I would move that Article 3 of Senate File 3387 be included in the Omnibus Higher Education Bill 2942.
Senator Roebling and Ms. Grimes, I'm just wondering before we do that, on 1311, is that date supposed to be September 11th, not September 1st, or is this coincidence?
Madam Chair, I believe it is supposed to be September 11th.
Okay. Then Senator Roebling moves to on 1311 to delete 1 and insert 11. All those in favor say aye.
Madam Chair, I think it would be on or after.
Yeah.
On or after. Senator Wieger moves. Let Senator Wieger move it.
I think so.
On line 1311. After service, insert on or, and delete 1 and insert 11. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Then, Senator Roebling, make your motion.
I renew my motion to include Article 3 of Senate File 3387 into the Omnibus Higher Education Bill 2942.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, then we're down to Article 4.
Madam Chair, this one is moving on several paths as well, and it is included in here, but at 3 o'clock it is supposed to be heard in the Judiciary Committee.
Oh.
And I know you received the notice saying that they wanted to see this bill in the Judiciary Committee, but they will be seeing it, and we are explaining that to them, that this is what they're seeing at 3 o'clock.
Oh, so we don't need to send this to Judiciary.
Unless we would make amendments, I would imagine that we wouldn't have to do anything different with it. But we are planning
to not do Article 4 until we found out what Judiciary Committee did.
Okay, that's fine then.
All right. Okay. Ms. Hegard.
Madam Chair, then, would you like me to walk through what this is? Okay. That's correct. This bill is traveling. I'm Susan Hegard with the Office of Higher Education, and this bill is traveling on several fronts. It's in this bill so that higher education can have a good look at it. It's in the K-12 technical bill, so Senator Wieger's committee can take a look at this. And then it's also traveling on its own to the Judiciary Committee. Senator Betzold is taking this and then amending it as we speak. I've got a draft actually right in front of me, and I'll walk you through some of the changes are that he'd suggested that we agree with. Basically, though, for those of you who don't know what the P16 partnership is, it's been around for about 5 years. It's a voluntary organization. President Brunig's, Chancellor McCormick, Commissioner Segrin, I'm on it, head of the for-profit and nonprofit private schools, and then all the other education stakeholders in K-12 and higher ed. Are on this P16 partnership. Over the last couple of years, though, we've really taken our focus from really being macro to actually getting down and focusing on specific to-do items. For example, getting alignment on the math standards or the science standards. The work group that I was assigned to head up is called the group that would establish a common student identification number. This is something that a number of states have taken a look at, trying to align their K-12 or P-12 and their higher education data systems. The federal government tried very badly and was not successful when they tried to do it at that level. Our feeling is that if we try to start at the state level with something that works for Minnesota, we're going to be successful. So I headed up a group across kind of stakeholders in higher ed and K-12. Very collaborative process, and in the end, what we decided on were several things. We decided that instead of creating a new number or using the Social Security number, that we'd use the existing MARS number, which every public school student gets when they start in K-12. Actually, now, though, when young children are screened, all public school kids are screened, they get a MARS number when they're coming into the K-12 system when they're preschoolers. So those students would be included on the K-12 site already. So we take the MARS number. It would then be run up into higher education. We worked with the Department of Administration on how to do this, and they said that we'd need to have legislative language, of course, which is why we're here before you today. in this work that we did in this work group, we basically looked at all of the data that we currently collect at the Office of Higher Education. We've had a long time, pretty robust, complete data system, enrollment system for higher education. On the K-12 side, they too have a long time, fairly robust data system. But the two aren't connected in any way at all. So we need legislation for the two to really be able to talk to one another. We walked through the data that's currently collected on each side, and I can just give you some examples of what the data is. But the broad categories are attendance data, and enrollment data, student demographic data, academic performance and testing data, special academic services received, like whether the student's receiving special education or gifted and talented services. And this data would only be available in the aggregate. It would not be individually identifiable. It would only be available in summary or aggregate form. For example, one of the benefits I think that we saw was, let's say you've got two groups of students who were at risk for whatever reason. One did well once they got to college, but the other did not. Could you look back and find out, was there a pattern of course taking that made a difference? Was it an after-school enrichment program that made a difference? Was it a combination of the two? And then you could be able to go back and try to make some changes on the K-12 side for educational improvement purposes. Let's see. We made sure that we were complying with federal data privacy and state data practices laws. The appropriate Tennyson warnings would be given on both the higher ed and the K-12 side. And I think just some examples right now of how we use our current data. We already collect this data in the higher ed system, as I said, in, on the K-12 side, but our Minnesota Measures report, all that data is rolled up from an individual on the from the individuals into aggregate, and we report that to you in that Minnesota Measures report. We have a new report coming out soon that looks at gender in higher education in terms of what degrees are men versus women taking, who's enrolling in math and science, who's completing and who's not. We wouldn't be able to do that if we could not roll our data up in the aggregate to talk with you about. So I don't know if you have any questions for me right now, but I'd be happy to answer any if you have them.
I did have a question. On 16.6, we're talking about the Minnesota Department of Education. Do we need to say that?
Madam Chair, that's correct, and I've been approached by the Private College Council staff about that, and we'd be very happy to state Minnesota Department of Education. There's some concerns about who else we might share this data with, and our goal is to share it with between the two cabinet agencies.
Okay. Madam Chair, should I move an amendment to put that in so that on line 6, page 16, in front of department, it would say Minnesota.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Ma'am Chair, on that same line, would you want Minnesota in front of office?
It is.
We could, to be safe, yeah. I suppose.
Yes. Why not? Okay,
Madam Chair, I also move that we insert Minnesota in front of the word office on line 6.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. What is meant by, Ms. Hegard, to analyze instruction in school districts as for purposes of improvement?
Madam Chair, that was language suggested to us by the attorneys at the Department of Administration, but the idea would be that you'd look at course-taking patterns, and then you'd be able to go back and then make improvements in the K-12 system, for example.
It almost sounds like a purpose statement to me. I mean, do you really – I mean, the whole idea is to be able to share data. Is this limiting or
– Well, Madam
Chair, if you wanted to analyze instruction for purposes of comparison, not just for purposes of improvement.
We're open, Madam Chair, to making changes here. I think what we were trying to do is make sure we said enough so that people knew what we were talking about, but not so much that people would get bogged down in the details. So it's a balancing act.
Right.
One thing I did want to just add, though, in terms of the changes that Senator Betzold is going to be proposing this afternoon, after this small section, we'd add four numbers. And the first would look at one chunk of data. It would be attendance data, including the name of the school or institution, school district, year, term of attendance, and term type. So on both sides, the higher ed office and K-12 agency, we look at enrollment and school data. So that would be kind of one chunk of information that we'd be looking at. The second would be student demographic and enrollment data. We do that on both sides. The third would be academic performance and testing data, the MCI test, ACT, SAT, those sorts of tests. And then the special academic services received would be special education, gifted and gifted services, PSEO participation, things like that. And then finally, we're adding some comfort language to folks that would say, where's the language? It says, any analysis of or report on the data must contain only summary data, aggregate data. Mm-hmm.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I believe this is very important. There's work that needs to continue to be done, but on the question of summary data versus individual information, what if a student is struggling, falling through the crack? There's been a need for intervention. Different things are documented. So-called dashboard indicators are lighting up. How could this be triggered to that student's parents or guardians? How can we track this as this person goes through the system rather than just aggregate the summary data so that there's some practical use to serve that student as well as the parents and documentation, too, as to what is being done to intervene?
Ms. Hegarn.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, that's a good question. I think they're connected but different. I think the student and their family and the teachers could always access some of that information through their own school and school district if they were interested in trying to figure out, you know, ways to improve the education for that student. I think the answer, though, is that aggregate data, if you find that a student fits into a particular category, you could look at the aggregate data that pertains to that particular student and then use the best practices, perhaps, to determine a way to improve the educational opportunity for that student. But we wouldn't be permitted to release individual, you know, information. I mean, the individual student could, I mean, I'm not an expert on data practices law, but there may be a way for that individual student to access their own information. But that's not the goal of this particular system. I mean, the goal is to try to inform districts and schools and policymakers for the benefit of students. But with regard to individual students, I think that's something different, and we wouldn't be permitted to release that type of information.
Well, Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, what's being done is very important, but ultimately what is delivered to that household, parents wondering what can be done, and especially as we review the remedial programs that we look at for what needs to be done for students that are trying to get at grade level in higher ed, but tracking them individually and what is reported to them is very important. And you know, we're going to be talking a lot more about it in E12, and I assume we'll have a joint meeting at some point. But I think it's incumbent that information be shared not only amongst educators but with the parents. So an alarm is going off if it isn't already on reports that they're getting. Otherwise, I don't know how much good it will ultimately do.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, the schools already, the K-12 schools already have the MARS numbers, yes. and each student has their own student record. So a lot of that may be done already in the K-12 system, and the tracking should be able to happen on an individual basis at that level. This is the connection piece, though, for the higher ed level. And, of course, then you get into that and reporting back to parents once the students are 18 sometimes becomes an issue, too. So, you know, as far as going back to the family at the higher ed level is a little trickier because the students have to sign off on giving information back to their parents once they turn 18, and not all of them are willing to do that, although a number of them do because the parents might be helping with their financial debts as they go through college. So sometimes it's a little carrot they can hold over their students to get them to report
back.
We're going to
lay over this article until we see what data privacy does and what the education committee does. But I know we want to carry it here as well, and we figure out the final version. So thank you very much, Ms. Hegarn. And Senator Roebling, I just want to revert back to that A1 amendment that Senator Tomasoni pointed out to me and incorporated into the omnibus bill. And what it does is, and someone could offer this for me, Senator Tomasoni, thank you. It basically, we put 8 2-year colleges at a resident-only tuition, and it kind of, and we paid for it in our appropriation to Minsku, and we kind of lock that in now, so that they can't go back and do a non-resident tuition. If they're doing just a flat resident tuition, we want to keep them there. So that's what this does. Any questions? Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. This is being incorporating this into the omnibus bill. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed,
aye.
Nay. Motion